Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.
State Treasurer David McRae is returning record amounts of money to Mississippians, whether it's through the College and Career Savings Program or the hundreds of millions in unclaimed money awaiting your claim. Treasurer David McRae says get your applications and claims in today. Treasury.ms.gov.
This is Gerard Gibbert, and thank you for listening to Middays here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert is on the air. Middays with Gerard Gibbert is powered by CSpire. Power your home or business with CSpire fiber. To learn more, visit supertalk.fm/CSpire. CSpire fiber powers Super Talk Mississippi.
Get ready. Get ready to go beyond the headlines and join a meaningful conversation with people from around the state. You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Midday Super Talk Mississippi. I'm your host, Gerard Gibbert, along with Will East in the Element Wealth Studio, guiding you through the middle of your day with facts, fodder, and fine music. Morning there, Will.
A little cooler out there this morning.
It felt fantastic, man. Actually, it got downright chilly last night.
Yeah.
I don't know what the low was here in central Mississippi, in the 40s, I think, right? But it got chilly.
It got chilly last night. This morning it was very fall-like.
Yeah.
After a very warm... This whole month has just been crazy. So last Thursday I was eating lunch and I was eating barbecue and I spilt it naturally all over my nice clean clothes. And so I had a meeting. I said, well, what can I need to, you know, I don't have time to go home. I had a pullover in my truck. So I put that on just to, you know, cover myself up. And of course, it was 88 degrees outside and I looked like a moron because I had this black pullover on. You know, I'm sitting there sweating. People are like, why are you wearing a pullover when it's 88 degrees and it's October, you know, 18th or whatever?
Well, but we've just been waiting for the first little cold front to come through. Thankfully, the weather wasn't as severe as predicted as the front moved through the Magnolia State late Saturday or early into Sunday. The a really strong shower at my house, little thunder, little lightning, little wind, but nothing serious. That's about 1 o'clock in the morning, Sunday morning. But then moved on through, cleared it out. Turned out beautiful yesterday, gorgeous today. We got the big barn burner tonight. If you're in the area in Rankin County at Representative Lance Varner's farm, Varner Farms, believe the governor is going to be in attendance as well. I believe Acting Commissioner Andy Gibson, Treasurer David McRae, I think maybe Insurance Commissioner Mike Cheney, Speaker of the House Jason White. We'll all be in attendance offering some remarks there on the big trailer. But the main thing is the house band will be providing entertainment. I practiced pretty hard by myself yesterday in my man cave, where I, as I call it, where I got my drum set up. My wife won't let me do it when she's in the house, so I had to wait till she was out with my daughter. Because it's me with headsets on and all you hear is drums, right? It's like, what the heck is that? My poor dog, he goes to the other end of the house as well. But we're all set, ready to go. Weather looks great. Well, the weekend in college sports in the state of Mississippi, a bit disappointing. In some circles.
Unless you're a Southern Miss fan, they
had
a big win.
They did. They had a great
4-0
game
in the conference. But, for Ole Miss, that Mississippi State game.
Man. Wow. A lot of armchair quarterbacks now, aren't they?
Brian Haydad looked dejected.
Yeah.
He was so grumpy. I talked to him Saturday night. He was so just grumpy.
Yeah.
I tried to cheer him up, but there was no cheering him up after that. That happened, and then, of course, the Lane rumors are everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
There's no news.
Yep.
Despite what all these Facebook posts are saying, you know.
Yeah. I don't know what to make of all that. Of course, the rumor that he may be headed to the University of Florida, they have relieved their coach, Billy Napier. I always thought that was a specious hire, honestly. Where'd he come from? Lafayette or something?
Yeah, and very disorganized.
Yeah.
Just watching that. That's the first Florida game I've watched in quite a while, and they just it was quite obviously that he was a little bit overmatched, not with talent, but with just the organization of a football team.
Sure seen.
So that's
the Ole Miss Georgia game, Ole Miss was unable to force a single punt. They scored every series. You probably aren't going to win. Of course, I think we maybe punted once, right?
Twice, I think.
Twice? Okay. Yeah. Well, that was the difference, honestly.
That was the difference.
Because they were struggling to stop Ole Miss's offense as well. So just two high-powered offenses out there doing their thing, and the defense is like, where are you? On both sides, so to speak. But, oh, well. So the season rolls on. Now, this morning, you may have noticed that Amazon Web Services has experienced an outage. It's not affecting all of the various websites and workloads that they handle for customers. It's gigantic, as you can imagine, but some are. Coinbase, Venmo, a couple that were affected. I know that perhaps we were concerned about our website here at SuperTalk because our hosting partner for some of our site functions also possibly affected. But, you know, this happens. And this is something, having been in the industry a long time, is nobody really ever notices the fact that it's just always working 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, until it's not.
Yeah.
Right? And we become conditioned, and I'm not saying this is a bad thing, to expect 100% uptime. And I don't think anybody's achieved that. Not among the major names of cloud services providers. And you could make the same analysis of telecom services as well. It's pretty unusual to never have an outage, though that's the goal, certainly. And it's typical also, Will, to have what are called service-level agreement provisions in the contract, the overall contract, with a customer. Basically says, hey, look, we guarantee you'll be up this percentage of the time. It's always going to be 99% and some change, usually goes out three more decimal places. The goal for the longest time in the industry was what we called five nines reliability, 99.999% of the time. So you could do the math there. 0.001% of the time amounts to a very small period of time. I hadn't done it lately, but we had all that spelled out in our contract. But what it says is, okay, and this is in your contracts, even with your cell phone providers, typically. If we don't achieve that goal, that target, we'll rebate you. And there's a long, complex formula for that. So we'll see what happens here.
So like 99% of the time it's up.
In this case, 99.999% of the time. So if you could multiply the 0.001 times 365 times 24 hours times 60 minutes, and you'll come up times the 0.001, and you'll get whatever that yields. It ain't a lot, I can tell you that.
If only we had that with Congress.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be nice.
We need a service level agreement, SLA for short, the acronym.
You won't shut down, you know, for 2 weeks. How long's it been? I don't even know.
It's easy because it's whatever the day of the month is. So we're on day 20. That's how many days we've been shut down.
And the longest is 35.
I think that's right. We got Congressman Michael Guest, speaking of which, joining middays at 11:05 to give us an update on that. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson provided a bit of an update this morning, which really was kind of a nothing burger. Said, yeah, we're still shut down. And the House, I believe, is not even in session. They're not even in Washington. So for the week, and I don't know if there's a possibility of a breakthrough where they'd all be called back to come vote to reopen the government. But at this point, it looks like at least for another week, we're shut down.
Wow.
Oh, man. So, and really at the heart of this controversy are the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, another misnamed piece of legislation. Yeah, that's at the heart of it. The enhanced subsidies, which are scheduled to expire at the end of this year. Many experts in the industry are saying you're getting to where it's too late because November 1st kicks off the enrollment period for the next year for those who obtain their coverage in the exchanges. And the concern is if you guys don't act, we're running out of time. Notices are going out. The industry can't react and reprice and retrench. Now, I don't know if that's true. I'm just telling you that's kind of the message that is coming from both healthcare policy analysts as well as the folks that run the exchanges in government and the people that sell coverage in the exchanges. All the above. What a dang mess we got on our hands. When we come back, it's Jeremy Nelson, president of Element Wealth.
This segment of Middays with Gerard Gibbert is brought to you by Covington County Hospital in Collins, where your health matters.
Now back to Middays with Gerard here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Right on cue there. We're back with you in the Element Well studio. We welcome now Jeremy Nelson, the president of Element Well. Hey, Jeremy, been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. It's good to be with you today.
Yeah, man. So we like what we see today. A lot of green on the screen. The Dow up 350, 360 points. The NASDAQ, 200 something, I think. Treasury yields are a mystery, honestly. Gold is a mystery. The funny money is a mystery. It feels like investors are – we went through a period where it was Fed watching. And I'm not saying we aren't still Fed watching. But now it's tariff watching, trade watching, right?
Yeah, I think we're kind of getting to that point now where what are the economic impacts of tariffs and the, you know, and kind of our view on global trade? You know, obviously, with the government shutdown, we're not getting all of the data, but we're kind of seeing, you know, some of the major investment banks, you know, putting out estimates of what they would expect right now. But yeah, I do think that we're kind of at a point now where we're going, okay, the Fed's made it clear that they're going to cut. They're not going to be as aggressive as the president would like, but, you know, they're going to cut a little bit here. So we kind of, I feel like we know what's coming from the Fed. But what we don't know is the impact of tariffs, right? We don't know, you know, how much corporations are eating versus how much is being passed through to the consumers.
There's all sorts of estimates about that, as you know, but we're not sure.
But we don't know. And then obviously, you know, when things like impacts on employment, right? Well, we know that. You know, there's these massive revisions that have been going on for, you know, not just this year. I think that's kind of a misnomer that like the revisions to the jobs numbers are – that's not a new thing. That's been going on for quite a while. Now, obviously, you know, the last one that got the
Bureau, BLS.
Yeah, the BLS person fired was the biggest.
Yeah.
But it's been going on for quite a while because of the collection rate. But, yeah, I think everyone's kind of holding on. the market is hanging in there. It's been a little bit more volatile. We're seeing a lot of days
where the VIX is up over 20, right?
Well, yeah, we'll see days where the market opens up and finishes down, or opens down and finishes up. And so you're starting to get a little bit of a break in the trend, yin and yang. But, you know, today we're open up well. I think people are still optimistic.
Well, the president sort of softened his tone about his trade negotiations with China, and likes to boast about what a great relationship he has. He said, I don't know if you caught this, and I don't know if the market cares about this, but he said we should learn more about Xi Jinping's life story and background, that it's impressive. I don't know what he's talking about there. The president knows something.
I have.
And I don't know if investors are kicking on that.
I have no clue, right, because, you know, we did see, what, two or three Fridays ago, we had that big 900-point sell-off in the Dow, right, because we were going to put the tariffs in. And then he kind of backed off, and then he kind of got back on it. And, you know, China is retaliating, right, with limitations on rare earth exports and things like that.
Yeah.
I don't see a solution here. I don't necessarily see a deal, right? We've kind of been waiting. We've been waiting on this for a long time, and I just feel like there's not a resolution at this point in time.
And with respect to trade policy, wouldn't you agree that our trade deal with China really just overshadows all the other ones?
It does, but it shouldn't.
I agree.
Right, because if we look at, like, you know, our exports to China – are half of what we export to Canada.
That's true.
It's about what we export to Mexico. It's similar. So you actually see, you know, very similar import-export figures from China and Mexico.
They don't take as much of our stuff as China. I mean, as Canada and Mexico.
Yeah. You know, Canada and the U.S. have actually a relatively balanced trade. So if we look at our largest export market on a single country, it's Canada.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And so it's going to affect all of the cheap crap, right?
Well, I'm thinking more of the reverse. I'm thinking more of the import side of things.
And that's ultimately where it hits the consumer, is that on a lot of the low-value goods that we buy from China, they're more expensive.
Right.
But they're still the low-value goods. It's not the expensive stuff. So I don't see the China trade deal as, like, the biggest, most important deal that we have.
Okay. Well, it seems like the market's hanging on it, though, is the reason I point that out. And there's probably another dimension to it, in that we are heavily reliant on China for things like rare earth minerals that we can't produce here or don't have the means to do at this point.
We're seeing an impact with that, and we're seeing an impact with farming.
Yeah.
Right. So not buying our soybeans, right? So China's retaliation is, okay, well, we're going to go to Brazil and Argentina. And now, you know, the president's come out and said, well, we're going to take some of this tariff revenue and subsidize the farmers. And the farmers are saying, well, no, we don't want subsidies. We just want to be able to sell our product.
Because that's not permanent. It's a one-time deal. And a lot of the farmers are expressing concern that China may never buy our soybeans again, which would be devastating.
Well, and I do think that as you get into negotiations with a country like China, you know, they don't have – you know, a republic like we do, a democracy like we do, or, you know, they're not parliamentarian like the Brits or the Canadians or the Aussies, right? So they've got a 100-year plan. They're willing to wait some of this out. And I think that that's what we see, in that there hasn't been, you know, a real formal meeting with Xi Jinping and President Trump. Yeah, I think that they're really kind of holding on, and they're, you know, rattling the sabers a little bit.
Yeah.
And so I think that this is something that continues on. But I don't know that from a broad market perspective, yes, it's impacting farming in certain areas, and we're going to see low-value goods be a little bit more expensive. But that's not enough to just take down the American economy.
No, I agree. All right. But this is it's a pretty significant week from an earnings perspective, and investors are bracing for that. Do you think maybe that today's bull market indicates optimism about the earnings reports?
Yeah, and I think that you're going to see, you know, relatively decent earnings within the tech sector. I think you're going to probably see within some other sectors a little bit more weakness. But here's the thing about right the tech earnings right now is a lot of this is somewhat incestuous.
Yeah.
Right? Like
it's hard to track, isn't it?
It is. Like, I mean, so for instance, right, we talk about, you know, Oracle has signed this $300 billion contract with OpenAI. Well, the annual value of that contract is more than OpenAI's actual annual revenue right now. Right? So the big question becomes, okay, yeah, we're seeing these corporations doing these deals that's driving up the estimates and driving the revenue. Some of it's being subsidized, you know, through venture capital that's invested in these AI companies, but they're losing money. And so what ultimately has to happen for it to be sustainable is you're going to have to start to see the actual spend on AI from the consumer and businesses justify the spend in the infrastructure.
Yeah, because they're certainly planning on that. They're expecting that. They're positioning for it. And then AMD as well, cutting deals, right?
So I was literally about to point this out. One of the things I've talked about for a while is, you know, NVIDIA really had a stranglehold with the chips for AI. And all of a sudden, but one of the things I talked about was that eventually competition catches up, right? The margins that they had in that business would erode at some point, because I remember 2 years ago, the CEO of Amazon, Andy Jaffery, he was talking about how Amazon wanted to create their own chips. Now, obviously, they were way away on that, but Google wants to do the same thing.
Yeah.
They were concerned about the concentration of supply in chips being from one company. And I said, well, ultimately what's going to happen is like the AMDs or, you know, maybe even the Intels of the world would start to catch up a little bit. That would create competition and compress margins. Well, now what do we see, right? A $50 billion deal between AMD and OpenAI.
OpenAI still is yet to produce a profit.
Not even close. Yeah,
right.
The estimates that I've seen is that they have about $12 billion a year of revenue. They're valued at over $500 billion and that they're losing $5 billion a year.
Unbelievable. Kind of reminds me of Amazon in the e-commerce business until AWS. AWS was carrying them. And now, of course, they turned the corner and the e-commerce business makes money.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break. We got Jeremy Nelson coming back in the Element Well studio. AMD, by the way, very impressive CEO, isn't she?
She is very impressive.
She's awesome.
Yeah. Yep.
We're coming right back. Stay with us.
From the sea.
You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert, here on Super Talk Mississippi.
We're back with you in the Element Well studio, visiting with Jeremy Nelson, the president of Element Wealth. Okay, so it's a volatile market. The VIX, which is the measurement of volatility, for those not maybe not familiar with that, it's north of 20. Anything over, what, 13, 14 is considered volatile, I think, generally speaking?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of look at that 13 to 17 range. It's generally, you know, pretty normal.
Okay.
Right? When you start getting below 13, you're going, it's, you know, volatility's a little soft, and you know, 17's not crazy. When you start getting 20 and up, that's where you go, okay, you start to pay attention.
And that's how we end up with days that you described in the last segment as well. We opened up 200 or 300, but we closed down 500. I mean, or vice versa, right?
And what that's showing is that there's less conviction. There's a little bit more of a mix of bulls and bears, and there's kind of like a struggle for control. I think ultimately right now the bulls are still winning. The longer term concern is just valuations,
yeah,
right? But valuations are not a good timing metric.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way you can look at the market today and say it's cheap.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about 30 times earnings on the S&P 500. So, you know, it's not cheap, but, you know, it's also not 1999. Now, some people will come to me and say, well, you know, it's not like 99 because back then none of the tech companies were making money. Well, that's not true because the four horsemen were actually making money.
They were making money, yeah.
Right? The big guys were making money. Yes, there were the pets.coms of the world, but there's, you know, so there are similarities. I do think that fundamentally the Mag 7 or, you know, we look at the almost 40% or so of the S&P 500 is in the top 10 stocks. That concentration does worry me, but ultimately, you know, these companies are fundamentally better than broadly what we saw in 1999.
You know, what does concern me, however, is that there's a bit of enthusiasm over our GDP. Of course, GDP is always a strong indicator and is considered a bullish factor for investors. But I'm not sure if you saw this, but I caught a report that I dug into in great detail that if you take out investment in data center infrastructure, instead of having a 3.5% GDP, it's like 0.1 or something. So the rest of the economy not really growing at that level.
What I would tell you right now is what's propping up the economy is kind of the field of dreams with AI.
Yeah, no doubt.
Now, and that's why I pointed out earlier, eventually the consumer is going to have to start spending money on this in order to make it profitable because, you know, hypothetically, right, like what happens if OpenAI's revenue doesn't get to where it needs to be and they've got this $300 billion contract with Oracle that they can't afford? Well, obviously Oracle believes that they're going to get there in order to do the contract, to make the investment. But there's also a bit of an arms race here, right? Where, you know, a couple years ago, Mark Zuckerberg, Meta CEO, came out and said, I would rather overinvest, right, than underinvest in this right now. You don't want to get behind, right? And there's been a lot of criticism about like Apple being behind.
Intel.
Yeah.
Well, Intel missed the boat years ago.
Yeah.
And we're one of the four horsemen in the 90s that built out the internet.
Yeah.
They, Dell, Cisco, Microsoft.
Yeah.
So, and all those companies were making money back then, to your point.
Very profitable.
Yeah, extremely.
But what you saw, if you actually go back and you look at the revenues of those companies back then, they started scaling up rapidly, and then there was like an air gap and they dropped.
Yeah.
Because there was an overinvestment.
That's
and
right.
Then it normalized, and then the wreckage afterwards was pretty tough.
I think Oracle, speaking about valuations, is a great company. My company was one of their first partners back in the early 90s. I actually met Larry Ellison back in those days when they had just gone public, I think, 89 or something like that, as I recall. But their PE is, what, 60 to 70? I mean, that's when it gets kind of scary,
doesn't
it?
So this is the fundamental problem right now, is that we've dislocated from classic discounted cash flow valuations, right? I saw... Yeah, I look at some of these PE ratios and I go, you know, these are big companies to pay this kind of PE. It would be different if it was some young up and coming company, right, that was really going to grow into it. But the PE ratios on you know, something like an Oracle are quite expensive. And even if you look at you know, the Microsofts of the world, look, they're great companies. They're just not cheap.
Yeah.
And if they were to normalize at all, you would run into a big issue for the market because the market is literally 40% in 10 stocks right now.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what investors need to be aware of, is what's driving it. I think you need to make sure, again, that you're diversifying because there are some good deals under the hood. But I saw an interview the other day with Tom Lee, who's on CNBC all the time. There was a podcast that he was on, and he was talking about how, like, Walmart and Costco have – they have actually got like 50-plus times P.E. ratios as well. And he was talking about how they've used technology to really streamline their operations, and that's justifying this new valuation. I'm like, well, but the profits aren't there and the profit growth rate's not there to really justify that kind of valuation. And he was talking about how banks could use AI, like JP Morgan could go from 30,000 employees to 20,000 employees using AI, and that would give them a better multiple. I'm like, well, the multiple is a function of like your growth rate, your beta, right? Your how much you fluctuate with the market and what's happening in interest rates. Just to randomly assign PE ratios based on these esoteric factors doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that's not a minimal impact on the E part of the PE.
You know, ultimately, yes, we will go through phases where people will just start assigning PE ratios. Back in 2021, it was total addressable market, right? Remember ARK?
TAM.
The ARK Innovation ETF, right? It was all, well, the total addressable market is this, and then all those companies got trashed by 80%.
That's right.
Right? So I think that, you know, ultimately the fundamentals matter, and hence why I think you need to be, you know, well diversified.
So talk about, I know what you guys do, and especially helping those who are planning to get to go into retirement at some point, want to make sure that they can live a comfortable life. How do you help them with that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the first thing that you have to do is you got to kind of sit down and you've got to inventory what you have. You've got to look at your current cash flows, your future cash flows, and you got to figure out, you know, where the money is going to come from, right? How are you going to generate that sustainable income in retirement? And you also have to do you got to look at the risk in your portfolio. You know, if you're going into retirement and you're sitting there just banking on markets continuing at the rate they've been going up, you might be sadly disappointed. I mean, I use the example of 2000. If you were 100% in the S&P 500, you took 4% a year out, you bumped it up by a couple percent a year to keep up with inflation, well, you ended up running out of money in your 80s, right?
Yeah.
And so you really have to understand what you own, how you're diversified, but more importantly, how are you going to generate paychecks in retirement, and how are you going to manage the unknowns, right? The volatility that could come down the road.
Are you feeling like that because people are living longer and they're a little concerned about their assets, they may stay in the workforce a little longer?
Yes, but what we're seeing is that a lot of people end up getting forced out.
Okay.
Right? Some people would like to, but then some people end up getting forced out of the labor force. I always tell people who are pre-retirement, you know, sometimes people don't know exactly when they want to retire. My point to them is, all right, well, let's figure out the point at which that you're working because you want to, not because you have to. Right? And that's the key there. And now, obviously, look, full Social Security is now 67. It's not 65 anymore, right? Now, Medicare is still 65. So 65 is still a big trigger for most people to look at. But the reality is, yes, we do live longer.
Yeah.
So a lot of people are having to work.
Well, because you may outlive your assets. That's the fear, is it not? Do you run into that some?
The number one fear financially, right, that people have is that their money won't last long enough.
Yeah.
And you have to, but the only way you're going to know that is to run a financial plan and test it and see what it looks like.
And that's what you guys do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you've done it for me and it's worked quite well. I can certainly say that with a high degree of confidence and experience for now, what, 5-6 years,
yeah,
I think. So, yep. Always good talking to you, Jeremy. Appreciate you coming in.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Gerard.
We are coming right back, folks, in the Element Wealth studio. Don't forget, at 11:05, it's Congressman Michael Guest.
Trust cares are.
You're listening to Middays with Gerard here on Super Talk Mississippi.
The people will who would like to have a king protested no kings. they're the ones that created the kingdom, the throne. They just don't like who's wearing the crown, I would put it at this point. Look, if they thought they could get somebody in that position to act as a king and just issue decrees and commandments that were consistent with their agenda, they would be all freaking over it.
They would have no problem. I actually saw a sign from the UK, and it said, no kings. I thought, huh.
Well, do we not celebrate No Kings Day on July 4th? Isn't that kind of the way that works?
Yeah, I saw there were some people that dressed up as revolutionary war people,
yeah.
You know, era
soldiers,
you know, cosplay basically over the weekend, and I thought, huh, I remember when the Tea Party people did that, and you called them racist.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that was kind of in protest of, as you recall, Barack Obama, who they thought was comporting himself as a king. But the main thing that got that going was, of course, the passing of the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
They just felt like that was oppressive and too much government involvement in health care and very restrictive. All of the above, absolutely, is the case in invasive of one's privacy. But the thing that really got it going that I remember from that period was that very smug head of the IRS, Lois Lerner. Remember, they brought her to the hill. And it was about the way they were approving or actually rejecting applications for nonprofit status with the IRS by groups that had a conservative bent to them. Yeah, that absolutely is. I mean, we talk a lot about the weaponization of government. That feels like kind of the starting point of that.
Well, it was not only that, there was a lot of Tea Party groups that were targeted for audits.
That's right.
Basically because they had Tea Party in their name. And that was, okay, well, they got Tea Party in their name, let's go ahead and audit them, which, you know.
Yeah, and I remember one, I can't remember her name now, but it seems like she was the head of the Tea Party movement. She went to the Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And made the statement there in the Congress, you're out of your swim lane, something to that effect. And she's right. It's you've forgotten that you work for us sort of deal. All that was absolutely correct and accurate. But, yeah, this is crazy. And, of course, these are the same people that wore masks like a sacrament, you know, that said you got to have 14 boosters to keep your job and carry around an ID card. And I mean, just a litany of crazy things that they insisted and mandated. Who could forget Joe Biden telling us how many people you could have at your Thanksgiving dinner?
Absolutely.
You can't go worship, right? Couldn't do that.
Couldn't go to church.
Couldn't go to church.
I remember them bulldozing basically skate parks in California,
yeah,
because teens were starting to gather there.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right.
There's a certain group of them that like control, and I think you and I and Jeremy were talking off the break. Man, if Bill Clinton was 40-something years old today,
yep,
he'd clean up.
Yeah, he was certainly a more reasonable person for a Democrat than any of the current-day Democrats. He kind of hits that moderate lane that a lot of people on the right and left would define themselves as being in. we don't really have that in the Democrat Party anymore. It's just way the heck out there on the left, and they continue to lean into it, which is just mind-boggling to me.
And they,
I don't get it.
I don't get it either. I mean, it's you have a few moderates out there. You know, John Fetterman. I mean, never in a million years would I have thought that I would agree with him on basically anything. He is the voice of common sense right now.
I agree.
On the Democratic side.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing to see somebody like him who was so, at the time, seemed radical, but kind of, you know, after getting to office, I mean, kind of just does what he believes. And I don't, you know, that's the other thing, is I don't believe that some of them believe half the stuff that they're spouting out.
Yeah, and though there were no reports that I'm aware of any sort of violence, there were peaceful protests, which is good. Estimated 6.5-7 million people across the country. New York City was kind of ground zero for that. But I saw some interviews where some of the attendees once again invoked violence as a solution. Stephen Miller, of course, a policy guy in the Trump White House, even talked about he just needs to be assassinated or something to that effect. Like, what's wrong with these people, man? Man, oh, man. Fox News, Super Talk News, coming up next from the Element Well Studio, then Congressman Michael Guest.
Your Hour of Middays with Gerard Gibbert is brought to you by the Mississippi Business Journal. Visit msbusinessjournal.com. Scott Coopwood, publisher and president.
And now, another hour of the talk that keeps Mississippi talking. Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
Begin your transition now.
Now on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It's hour two of Middays. We are live in the Element Well Studio. It's our pleasure to welcome now Congressman Michael Guest. He represents Mississippi's 3rd District. Congressman Guest, good to have you on this morning, sir.
Gerard, great to talk to you again. I hope you had a great weekend.
Yes, sir, other than some disappointing football for the Bulldogs and the Rebels.
That it was. Thank goodness Southern Miss was able to pull out a victory.
Absolutely.
Yeah, not the football weekend that we were all hoping for.
Yeah, exactly right. But the weather's turned off pretty nice. So, all right, you guys are not in Washington. You're not in session right now, right?
That's right. The House is not in session. The Senate is in session. They will be voting again later today to try to break the filibuster to pass the CR that the House sent to the Senate some 4 weeks ago. Not expected that the vote is going to change today. Had hoped that maybe once we got past the No Kings rally that there may be some more moderate Democrats who would consider caucusing with Republicans to reopen the government. But from the information I'm hearing, I don't think that that's going to happen today. But we do have a big deadline coming up on Friday. Friday is when there are hundreds of thousands of federal employees who will not be paid, including federal law enforcement. And so that creates an inflection point, I think, for the Senate. And I'm also been told that the Senate will take up a bill on Wednesday that would authorize the payment of all essential federal employees during the shutdown.
Okay.
So that is something Republicans intend to bring to the floor, again, to kind of minimize some of the impact of the shutdown that has now gone on now into the fourth week.
And, Congressman, we have concerns about our United States Armed Forces members that are serving active duty members, in particular in our military. We found a pot of money to get them paid in the last period, but I don't think we have that in the next one, right?
Yeah, you know, the Trump administration was able to find research and development dollars, which they were able to shift to pay our military. I don't believe that there is enough money left, particularly in the R&D budget, to pay salaries for the next 2 weeks. Now, the administration may be able to find some additional dollars. But look, I got to give the president a lot of credit here, Gerard. I mean, the president has worked very hard to minimize the damage, the impact of the shutdown.
Yeah.
He's paid the military, and he's found money to pay them, which is the right thing to do. Some of my Democrat friends were upset about that. But look, I give the president credit for going out there, finding those dollars. He has kept the WIC program, a nutritional program used by pregnant women, new mothers. He is using tariff money to keep that program afloat when that program ran out of money shortly after the shutdown. The president is looking at ways in which he can find dollars to pay federal law enforcement at this point. That's still something that the administration is doing. And so Donald Trump has done all he can to minimize the damage. But at this point, we have seen really no breakthrough with Democrats that they are willing to come to the table to end what will, after tomorrow, be the second longest shutdown in government history, reopen the government so that we can get back to doing the people's business.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. He has done his dead level best to try to minimize the pain, for sure. So here's a procedural question for you, Congressman. I'm not sure I even understand. Who can actually put such legislation on the floor in the U.S. Senate? Is that strictly up to Senate Majority Leader Thune? How does that work?
Yeah, as I understand, I think their rules are very similar to ours in that it does require the Majority Leader, in this case Thune, to be able to put legislation on the floor. I do believe that the Senate has a process very similar to what we have in the House, that if you have a certain number of members, then legislation can go directly to the floor, and then the House, it's known as a discharge petition. I think they have something similar in the Senate, but it's going to be up to Thune to be bringing the legislation to the floor. Either he has to bring it or he has to allow Schumer. And for a number of weeks, he allowed Schumer to bring the Democrats' counter proposal to open the federal government. That was the proposal, if you remember, Gerard. It had roughly $1.5 trillion in new spending.
Yeah.
Some of that would go back to reimburse states that allowed illegal immigrants to opt into their health care system. It
yep.
abolished the $50 billion rural hospital fund. It reauthorized some of the funding that had been cut in the rescissions package. And, you know, it had money in there for a lot of LGBTQ. There were tens of millions of dollars for the LGBTQ programs out there, which many of us don't feel should be funded with federal taxpayer dollars. And
right.
So they were allowed to put that bill on the floor. It failed. At this point, Schumer is not allowed to put that version on the floor.
Okay.
And so it will be strictly up to John Thune as to what legislation they choose to take up.
Okay, gotcha. Well, but you don't expect the outcome to be any different at this point, do you, Congressman?
I don't. I don't see that there has been any movement. I know that we are past the pressure point of the No Kings rally, that there were a lot of people who believed that the Democrats were not even going to consider reopening the government till they got past the rallies this weekend. We're on the other side of that. I'm hearing that once the notices go out at the end of the month, beginning of next month, that the Democrats may be willing to consider reopening. But, you know, here's the thing is the Democrats are wanting to close the government because they want the extension of the Obamacare subsidies.
Yeah.
That in and of itself is roughly $500 billion over the next 10 years. But they're not willing to negotiate. I mean, that's what Jeffrey said. Jeffrey said, we're not willing to negotiate. It's an all or nothing. And look, Republicans just aren't going to give the Democrats what they want in this case.
Sure.
The Affordable Care Act has been a complete failure. It is anything but affordable. It is being propped up by federal tax dollars, in this case, subsidies going directly to insurance companies. And Republicans have said, if you want to talk about what we can do to improve health care, open the government. But I'll just tell you, you know, I can't speak for all Republicans. I can only speak for one. But I never intend to vote for what the Democrats are asking for. just to get them to reopen the government for 7 weeks. That's not going to happen. We know that 7 weeks actually isn't even 7 weeks anymore. We're now roughly a month. We're just asking the Democrats to open the government between now and November the 20th, and they're unwilling or reluctant to do so. So I think we're going to continue to be in this standoff probably for several more days, if not the foreseeable future, Gerard.
So you've noticed that there are some in your house, of course, in the House, that and on the Republican side, I think 14 last count I saw, that are in favor of some degree of extension of the enhanced subsidies. And then this morning there are reports that there's some Republican senators that are certainly willing to have that conversation as well. Where do you stand on that? Is there kind of a version of that that you could live with to continue to some extent these enhancements?
Well, you know, I take the position. I think that we've seen Mike Johnson really talk through it at his multiple press conferences he has every day. Is look, if we want to talk about these enhanced Obamacare subsidies, one, let's open the government.
Yep.
And then the next thing is, one, I believe that we need to put income limits on these subsidies. You know, if you look at the figures, roughly 35% of all the subsidies go to families making $100,000 or more. And so these are not necessarily families who are right at the poverty line. In some cases, they're families making hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they're able to apply and receive these subsidies. So I think we need to look at income limits. I think we need to look at putting guardrails in place, because I've seen reports that some of the policies are what are known as phantom policies, that there aren't actually policies of individuals. And so insurance companies are able to use these phantom policies not to insure individuals, but strictly for profit. And the thing I think is most important, if we're going to shut down the government, if this is the most important thing that we are dealing with as a country, I think the Democrats should put forth a plan as to how they're going to pay for that.
Yeah.
If we're going to have $500 billion in insurance subsidies, then what programs are they willing to cut to pay for those?
Yeah.
And we've not heard that. All we've heard is just this will be added to the national debt. And I think Republicans are tired of spending money that we're not on programs that we can't afford to pay for.
We'll take a break right here, but if you can hang with us, we'll continue this discussion.
Would love to. Yes, sir.
We got Congressman Michael Guest. We're coming right back.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
Let's do this.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
Let's go.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Middays. We're visiting with Congressman Michael Guest. All right, so, Congressman, is it possible we can see a breakthrough on this? Because I understand your position, and you're right that these enhanced subsidies are cost about $40 billion a year. That's on top of the $80 billion-plus already that the just standard original Obamacare ACA marketplace subsidies cost. So you're looking at $120, $130 billion a year of what, as you indicate, are simply payments to the insurers that sell their coverage in the exchanges. This isn't cash money vouchers that goes to the subscribers. You sign up, and the way the law works, your premiums are limited to a certain percentage of your income, and everything over that, the government picks up and sends directly to the insurer.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, you know, and that's what I think a lot of people don't understand. I mean, these are subsidies to the insurance company. And so these monies go directly to the insurance companies. You're exactly right. They don't go to constituents. They don't go to the individuals. They go to the insurance companies. There have been allegations that there are many fraudulent policies because there are no claims that are made on those policies. And so there needs to be guardrails in place to stop waste, fraud, and abuse. I think when people think about subsidies for healthcare, they think about people who are at or near the poverty line. They don't think of individuals and families who were making, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And again, you know, we're $38 trillion in national debt. And so, you know, at some point, we've got to step back and we've got to say, look, what are some of the driving costs of that debt that we're incurring?
Yeah.
And some of that's healthcare. Healthcare is a big part of that.
Yep.
And so this is a way for us to begin to get that spending curve under control. And so I think that there would be people who would consider some sort of modified enhanced subsidies. But I think that there is not an appetite in the House, at least, and I can only speak for the House, are not a widespread appetite, and I don't think Mike Johnson is going to put on the floor a flat extension of the Obamacare subsidies. And we see Jeffries has said, look, he's not in favor and does not support a one-year subsidy. He doesn't support us negotiating changing this program. He wants the program extended as is indefinitely, and that is the only thing that he will be supportive of.
Okay.
So he's drawn a line in the sand. And he said, hey, we don't want to negotiate. This is a hostage situation. This is a take it or leave it. If you don't give us what we want, then we're going to keep the government shut down. And that's what we've seen now going on for week four.
Okay. So I didn't realize that. So Schumer says, no, it's got to be permanent, that just an extension
not
for
Schumer,
a year.
Jeffries.
Oh, Jeffries, pardon me, on the House side. Okay. I apologize. I missed that. Yeah. But my guess is, Schumer may feel the same way because, you know, like I said, there are Republicans that said, well, okay, well, if you guys will just open the government up, I'm talking about in the Senate, we'll talk about this, you know, and really I think what they mean is we'll talk about ways to address this health care problem that's affecting all of us. And this all goes back, Congressman, you talk about the Affordable Care Act, how it's made premiums and the cost of health care anything but affordable, goes back to some wizard back in 2009-10 time frame that said, hey, insurance shouldn't cost more than 8.5% maximum of your household income.
That's right. You know, when Obamacare was being debated, when it ultimately was being passed out of the Senate, and House strictly along party lines. I mean, the American people were sold a bill of goods. You know, I remember that if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor, that quality of care is going to go up, cost is going to go down. And I think many of us, when we heard all the arguments that were being made in favor of that, many of us were skeptical and said, hey, you know, we don't believe what we're being told. And now as we look back many years later, we see that the cost of medicine has gone up dramatically. While health care has improved at some level, it's not improved to the level that we had been promised. And again, this is a major driver of our national debt, which is health care. And how do we look at health care as a whole? And look, if you want to talk about, and I think it would be a great discussion for the House and Senate to have, is what can we do to overhaul the Affordable Care Act? What can we do to make sure we're taking care of our rural hospitals, we're taking care of people in rural communities, but what can we also do at the same time that we're going to try to get costs under control? And just passing an extension of the Obamacare enhanced subsidies, which were supposed to expire at the end of COVID, and we're well past the end of COVID, I believe it's going to do nothing but continue to drive cost up.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it seems like it. Is there any further discussion among your colleagues, Congressman, about other areas that we can cut spending, especially given that it looks like we got an increase on the defense side of the discretionary component of government, but that other half of discretionary spending, which is the massive agency complex, I know there have been some permanent layoffs, it appears, or terminations of some of the jobs as part of this furlough process during the shutdown. Any discussion there about cutting some spending?
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons we need to get the government reopened, Gerard, is, you know, in the House we have passed all 12 of the appropriations bills. If you look at those 12 bills, nine of those 12 bills, we actually reduced spending from the year before. And so the bills that increased spending were Homeland Security, Defense, and Milcon VA. The other nine bills, we actually had a reduction in spending. So an overall reduction in spending from the previous FY25. And what we're trying to do is get the appropriations bills. We're trying to get back into regular order, get the appropriations bills in the House and Senate, get those bills worked out, the differences in those bills, so that we can fund the government by way of appropriation bills, not CR. But I will tell you that the appropriation bills in the House, again, nine of those 12 bills, we came in under the amount of money that we spent in FY25.
Okay.
And an overall decrease in spending. So there is an effort on the Republican side to bring spending down. Now, that only accounts for discretionary spending, which is 25% of the spending.
Yep.
The other 75%, as we've talked about before, is mandatory spending. And that mandatory spending will go up as long as we continue to see health care costs soar.
Right. But I did want to point out, of the 25%, as you point out correctly, which is discretionary, that goes generally about half to defense and half to so-called non-defense domestic spending. But both the House and Senate passed legislation that does increase defense spending. Man, it seems like at a minimum we got to reduce the non-defense discretionary spending by at least that amount.
Yeah, and the increase in the defense spending, I will say, was fairly minimal. There was an increase,
okay,
but it wasn't a huge increase,
yeah,
again, from FY25. And there were corresponding cuts and actually additional cuts in the other nine spending bills. So we would actually be in FY26. We would spend, again, looking at the 12 bills in total. If what passed the House Appropriations Committee were actually signed into law, we would actually spend less in FY26 than we did in FY25.
Okay, gotcha. Well, I do think that the increase on the House side was somewhat less than what the Senate NDAA was calling for, as I recall.
Yeah, and look, you know, we got to make sure that we're paying our troops.
Sure.
And we've got to make sure that we're making that investment. You know, you talk about Reagan's vision of peace through strength. You know, we are able to stay out of conflicts if we have the best trained, best equipped fighting force in the world, which we currently have. But we know particularly what we've seen with defense spending in China, that we are in a new Cold War, a new arms race, and we can't afford to fall behind. And so that's why it's important, with all the events happening in the Indo-Pacific, that we continue to have a robust investment in our military infrastructure and making sure, again, that we properly pay and support our troops.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm concerned about that, man. I think you would agree. If anybody needs to be prioritized to get paid, it's the people that serve in our uniform.
We that is right. And look, I give the president a great deal of credit for finding money to pay our troops and not using them as a pawn in this government shutdown.
Yeah.
And I continue to support his efforts. And I think that there is going to be legislation offered in the Senate this week that would pay all essential employees, those individuals, not only military, but law enforcement, anybody that has been deemed essential. I'm told that that bill is going to come to the floor possibly on Wednesday. And we'll see if Democrats will support that legislation.
Okay, good. That's good to know. Well, we hope we get some breakthrough here pretty soon, Congressman. We got to go. We appreciate you joining us. And if anything breaks, I'm sure we'll have you back on to enlighten us. Thanks a lot, man.
Yes, sir, Gerard. Good talking to you as always.
You bet. We're coming right back in the L studio.
From the Seabrook, Mississippi, Days with Gerard Gibbert.
It is on.
On Super Talk, Mississippi.
All
Welcome back, everyone. It's Middays. Super Talk Mississippi from the Element Wealth Studio. We appreciate Congressman Michael Guest for calling in today, giving us an update on what is just a stalemate at this point. Doesn't seem like there's any movement there, Will. No, I think both sides are making a political calculation, in particular the Democrats more than any. I think they believe that as long as they keep beating this drum of ACA subsidies and holding out for that, and I honestly think they are intentionally dragging this out so that the government remains shut down when folks start getting these notices in the mail or their email in the next few days about their premiums next year. Open enrollment starts November 1st. And at this point, it's in the books that the enhanced subsidies are scheduled to expire. And in doing so, these letters, these notifications are going to be going out. Folks are going to learn that their premiums, those that buy their coverage in the exchanges, are going up. In Mississippi, by the way, that's 340,000 people. So once the enhanced subsidies were implemented in early 21 as part of the American Rescue Plan, enrollment spiked. It doubled, as a matter of fact, because the government was saying, we'll pay more for it, thus the enhanced subsidies. And so a lot of people that were on the sidelines that said, well, I can't afford it at this price, all of a sudden, wow, I can afford it at that price. They're out-of-pocket expense aspect of it. And so now we got 24 million in the country. Turns out, you know where most of them are? Red states. In fact, in 65% of the congressional districts that were carried by the president in 24, the enrollment in the ACA exchanges exceeds 10%. According to the Urban Institute and Kaiser Family Foundation, and they're kind of the leading authority on all things health care policy, the state of Mississippi should expect to see, as far as those who were, again, enrolled in the exchanges, an increase of between 350 and 370% on average, as far as the enhanced subsidies expiring. So this is really interesting information, and it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out in the midterms, depending on what happens. You heard the congressman saying, Ben from Madison said that he wanted us to ask that question. I'm just seeing your text. Apologize for that, Ben. But we did ask the congressman that, and he said he's a hard no on permanent extension, right? But you got his colleague there in the House, the minority leader, Hakeem Jeffries, that says, yep, we're only on board if we're going to extend these things permanently. A short-term, temporary extension is not acceptable. We can't get behind that. That's what that's where it stands right now. So I'll admit I'm concerned about Republicans and so-called swing voters in these districts learning about these their insurance going up substantially, and they're going to look for somebody to blame. And I'm afraid the Democrats are going to pounce on that. It's those mean old Republicans that won't extend those enhanced subsidies. The reality is I know, and now our listeners know better. Our audience knows better. They're paying attention to this. We certainly talk about it a lot here because it's the heart of what's got the government shut down. But here's what we know, Will. Once you put welfare out there, it's so dang hard to claw it back. It's impossible.
You can't.
What is it, Milton Friedman, the famous free market economist, certainly those from my era who studied economics, just latched onto every word, Uncle Milty, as we affectionately called him. He's the one that said there's nothing so permanent as a temporary government program. That's what this is. This is a temporary government program, and it don't matter what your political stripes are. All you know is that your cost of living goes up and you want a pound of flesh. That's just how our people are. We've become so conditioned to the federal largesse. Our state is, sadly, and I'm not placing blame on anybody here, including our lawmakers, but I'm just saying if you look at the Medicaid program, which we didn't create, the Democrats did, Lyndon Johnson did in 1965. And you look at the cost of the Medicaid program in this state, the combined federal and state dollars exceed the state's general fund budget. That's how big it is. We get $7 billion a year from the federal government to operate the Medicaid program. And if we said no to that, by the way, I dare say the hospitals in this state would crash. Every single one of them would, because they're required to treat everybody that comes in their ER because of a Reagan-era law. And I don't think you could get, I know Thomas always talks about we should repeal that law. He offers no alternative to that. If somebody shows up, they're in labor or they're experiencing a heart attack and they can't pay for it, no healthcare professional is going to say, I'm sorry, you just have to die in the street. That's just not going to happen. Not going to happen. So the question is, how do we address that? How do we deal with that so that it doesn't break us and so that it's fair? And that's a confounding question, honestly. There ain't nothing easy about that. So that's what's going on at the federal level and trying to relate that to the state as well. Now, Kaiser estimates about 70,000 in Mississippi would drop their coverage. 70,000 out of 340. That's a lot. And that means now that they're going to suck up resources when they need medical care. They're not going to pay. And we end up paying in our commercial premiums.
Yep.
Is how it works. So you can't have a free market in health care until you're able to deny care to those who can't pay. And if you do that, people will die. And that's not acceptable, I think, to society either. Now, there's some that are just hardliners that said, yeah, okay, they just have to die. I don't think that's going to be popular, is what I would say. I don't think that's a popular position.
It's not right.
Yeah. So, and Ben also points out the military action in Venezuela. Yeah, this is getting a lot of attention. The president was out posting video, was he not, Will, of attacks on these boats and I think a submarine as well that they maintained was full of drugs, fentanyl in particular. And so, yeah, this is a very challenging, controversial question. Is this use of American assets as an act of war, and should that require the Congress to declare it? You're going to see more and more about that. Already there's a lot of buzz about that, and there's some pushback. Rand Paul, who the president can't stand, he's already spoken up about it, as has Thomas Massey. And I know the president now says he's going to find somebody to run against Thomas Massey. Not a fan. I don't know. This is a tough one. I mean, I think it's a tough one in that, hey, is the president acting in a way that is more of emergency in nature, where he's defending the nation from the infusion of these drugs into our country, which are killing people? And the same is true with tariffs. Now, I gotta share something on that. Stephen Moore, an economist who worked for the president in the first tenure, in his first term, he has a publication called, or a group called, Unleash Prosperity. And he's a frequent guest on the Business Networks. He's been on this program a couple of times.
Yeah.
He's awesome. And he was talking about the Supreme Court, which is now in session, of course, taking up the issue of the legality of tariffs imposed by the executive branch. You know what he said this morning? His prediction that the Supreme Court's going to strike it down. I was shocked. He said either 6-3, 7-2 he expects to rule against the president's authority to impose tariffs unilaterally. And the president's lobbying for that. I heard him this morning saying this would be disastrous for our country if we don't find that these tariffs are constitutional and that he's within his authority under emergency powers and so forth, man, you talk about wreak havoc on the markets. If just the uncertainty, it's the volatility that spooks markets. Oh, wait, the president's putting these tariffs, now the Supreme Court says you can't. Your head's spinning, and they want stability is what they want. In the meantime, the president's diligently working with Xi Jinping in China to try to cut some deal. It's also being reported that he might actually show up at the Supreme Court and be in the gallery and witness the proceedings when they take up the tariff issue. Final segment is on the other side of the break. It's Mondays. That means Super Talk Outdoors with Ricky Matthews at 12:05.
Poly up a miss.
Are we going to do this?
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
Keep rolling. 3, 2, 1.
On Super Talk, Mississippi.
What goes up must come down. Spinning wheel, got to go. Pony, let the spinning wheel spin. You got no money and you got no home.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Middays from the Element Well Studio. So you probably saw that Secret Service found a suspicious hunting stand with a line of sight to Air Force One. And recommended that the president, of course, I think they're in charge. I think it's like demanded that the president use the shorter stairs to board the plane. Is what I'm reading here, to stay lower, I guess. So that would be a problem when you sweep the area. There's a hunting stand that they declared as suspicious, but with line of sight to the president's plane. That's certainly a problem. For sure. You know, we were talking about AWS being down, experiencing some outages. So I'm unable to get to the Wall Street Journal website. And I checked on multiple devices just to make sure. Now, maybe it's cleared up since then. But last I checked a few minutes ago, I couldn't get to the Wall Street Journal site. Interesting. Something going on there, and
yeah,
I didn't know.
Mine's down too.
Okay, I didn't know if it was related to that. I'm not sure.
I bet it is.
I wonder if they host their site with AWS. I'm kind of thinking it might be related though, huh? Yeah, I just tried to.
You don't realize how interconnected a lot of this stuff is until it goes down.
Oh, big time! Yes, exactly. So I just tried to access it again and got a service unavailable, 503 error, right? Is that what you're getting?
Problems at Disney Plus, McDonald's app, New York Times, Reddit,
there
Ring
you
doorbells,
go.
Robinhood, Snapchat, United Airlines. You mentioned Venmo earlier.
Yep.
Yeah, so that's a very good chance that that's what's happening.
Also a report just over the weekend, well, the average new car price in this country, $50,000.
Wow.
First time ever. That's $750 a month for the average person who finances their vehicle. $50,000. I remember when that was a serious luxury vehicle, right? This is the average now.
Yeah.
$50,000. And I think with the tariff stuff and the rare earth issue, I didn't realize how many of those rare earth materials are used in the production of a vehicle. That's causing problems as well. So, but a lot of parts are made, unfortunately, in China that are imported and used in the manufacturing process. So they are subject to the tariffs, and that's driving the price up. I have seen reports that from the various financial media that so far American companies are absorbing about 65% of the increased tariffs. Just not passing that on to customers. But that's not expected to last, that they will start passing that on. They just can't sustain it. But right now, they're hesitant to raise prices as a result of tariffs, and so they're just eating them. And then it is true that some of the foreign exporters, they are absorbing about 20 to 25%, and then consumers in America are being hit with the remainder, which is 10% or so. So that's what I think. Reuters and Bloomberg both reported that, you know, based on their assessment and analysis and just investigation and working with these companies. Gary in Carrollton says Affordable Care Act is providing affordable insurance for its target audience. Well, certainly those who obtain their coverage in the exchanges, which generally speaking will are individuals, subcontractors, retired folks that aren't yet on Medicare in that kind of squishy period before they turn 65, there are a number. Just independent contractors, I think I mentioned that. That's who buys their coverage in the exchanges. The rest of us get it from our employers, and that accounts for about 85%, if not more than that, of the total commercial coverage. Commercial meaning not Medicare, not Medicaid, not government provided. And the ACA are marketplaces of commercial insurance policies. So mostly, again, from the individual market, meaning they don't participate in the group market with their employer. Many of them are not employed, or they're small businesses and they don't offer coverage. That's pretty typical as well. But, yeah, and the deal that the Democrats are pushing really hard, you may have seen this narrative, is, let's see, a 60-year-old couple making $85,000 a year losing the enhanced tax credits would increase their premiums by about $1,900 a month. And I'll explain why that is so sharp for that particular case on the other side of the break, because they're not giving you, as you can imagine, the whole story here.
We have to do it tomorrow.
Oh, tomorrow. We're out of time. My apologies. I'll get to it tomorrow. That's right. It's Monday. We're out of here today. Back with you tomorrow. Until then, stay safe and God bless.
Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.